Welcome, listeners, to episode 16 of the West Virginia Leaders of Literacy podcast. I'm your host, Becky Lewis, and in this episode, I'm joined again with Brandy Turner, and we will be speaking with two experts from the nonprofit organization TNTP to continue our discussion on summer learning loss. Welcome to the West Virginia Leaders of Literacy podcast, where we engage in educational conversations to strengthen early literacy in West Virginia. Are you ready to become a leader of literacy? Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today on this episode as Brandy and I continue our discussion on summer learning loss. Welcome back, Brandy.
Thank you, Becky. I am excited to be here.
I'm really excited too, and I'm especially excited for our two guests that we have from the nonprofit organization TNTP, which is formerly known as the New Teacher Project, Bailey Cato Zuprick and Kate Glover. Bailey Cato Zuprick currently serves as the Partner, Practice, and Impact at TNTP. Formerly, she taught 8th grade science in Durham, North Carolina, and coached early in her career teachers in Jacksonville, Florida. Most recently, she led the team that produced TNTP's 2018 report, The Opportunity Myth. Bailey and her family have made Memphis their home for the past 6 years, and Bailey earned a Bachelor's of Arts in Political Science and Sociology Criminology from the University of Oklahoma. Kate Glover is a Director of Academics with TNTP, where she works with states, districts, and schools to reach their goals for students. Most recently, her work is focused on improving literacy outcomes and the implementation of high-quality, standards-aligned instructional materials in literacy classrooms. Before TNTP, she taught early education and worked for other nonprofits, providing direct literacy services to students and teachers. Kate earned a bachelor's in political science and journalism from the University of Richmond and a master's of arts in education policy from Brown University. Ladies, let me start off with thanking you so much for joining us today to talk about summer learning loss.
Thank y'all. We're excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Can you ladies give us some background for our listeners regarding your work in education and your work with TNTP?
Of course, this is Bailey. I will start by describing a little bit about who TNTP is. We're a national nonprofit organization that works with teachers, schools, and systems to ensure that students are having high-quality academic experiences and that communities and families are engaged in thinking about the education they want their students to have. I've been at TNTP for about 9 years, first leading our Nashville Teaching Fellows program, then partnering with the Memphis School District to develop and implement a strategy to improve literacy outcomes. About 4 years ago, I took over leading the team that wrote our national report, The Opportunity Myth, where we studied the experiences students were having in 5 districts around the country, and now lead our Practices and Impact team. That's just a fancy name for the team that's responsible for codifying best practices and improving TNTP's impact on students.
And this is Kate. I've been at TNTP now for a little over 6 years. And like Becky said, been working closely with schools, districts, and states to help them reach their goals for students. Most of my recent work is actually very aligned with your work here, as it's been focused on getting more students reading on grade level, specifically helping teachers use high-quality, standards-aligned instructional materials in their literacy classrooms. And before TNTP, I was in the classroom working with pre-kindergarten and kindergarten students, and I also worked for a few direct service organizations providing literacy services to students and to teachers.
Great. Thank you, ladies. Bailey, this next question is geared towards you. You recently posted a blog titled Remediation Won't Help Students Catch Up, Here's What Will. And in it, you refer to the study that was done by NWEA regarding the impact that the COVID-19 crisis will have on learning. Can you give us a quick snapshot of that study and the results that they found?
Of course. The folks at NWEA administer the MAP assessment, or the Measures of Academic Progress assessment. And they've historically done a whole bunch of research on what they call learning loss that happens from the typical end of one school year to the start of the next school year using the assessment data they have. About 5 million American kids a year take the MAP assessment. So they have a good chunk of data that enables them to look at kids' performance year over year. Their research team took that historical data on what they think of as the typical slide that occurs from spring to fall in the MAP, and projected what they thought a COVID slowdown would look like. Without going too far into the analytic methods they use, because we could spend a whole podcast talking about those, they basically see how much of this past year's learning students would lose if they assumed that in-person school stopped on about March 15th. And their preliminary estimates suggest, based on their historical data, that if students will return in fall 2020 with about 70% of a typical year's learning gains in reading and about 50% of a typical year's learning gains in math. So essentially said that kids would come back to school with much less learning than they would come back with normally, given the slowdown in instruction that occurred as a result of COVID-19. They call out really specifically, if you dig into their report in detail, that younger students are expected to experience the greatest learning loss. They don't go into, you know, hypotheses about why, but my guess would be that, you know, I have a four-year-old at home, and at-home learning has been hard on a computer for a four-year-old. Won't say anything more than that, although I imagine your listeners can relate. The other thing that I think Kate and I have talked some about related to this study and our youngest learners specifically, MAP estimated that students would lose more gains in math than in reading as a result of COVID. Mm-hmm. But if I think about delivering early reading instruction virtually, I think a lot about how important it is that students can see teachers' mouths for phonics and how hard that is remotely, or if kids are, you know, coming back to school in the fall wearing masks. Actually, the study that MAP did projected the amount of learning they expected kids would lose based on historic data they have.
That's so interesting. Bailey, I didn't even consider the idea of going back to school wearing masks and how that alone is going. I mean, there's so much yeah. going to impact, but the phonics instruction, and, you know, I'm putting together a presentation right now on fluency and just thinking about how often our kids being read to fluently by someone who knows how to teach that practice. Right. So you're so right. You know, I'm also thinking about, you know, those statistics that NWEA has, and we know that typical summer learning loss research indicates that the effect on children with poverty are the greatest because we know they have less access to opportunities and experiences and minimal conversations and reading. So clearly, those children will have a greater impact than a typical summer. But is there anything out there that talks about what that impact might be on our quote unquote average or on grade level students? Is the statistic that NWEA provided talking about our children in poverty or talking about our average children?
The NWEA study itself was focused on average students. They okay. did not tease out different demographic groups or performance levels in what they've released publicly to date. Although I did recently, y'all see a study from the consulting firm McKinsey that used NWEA MAP data that tried to answer this question from the what's going to happen in the fall mm-hmm. perspective. bit less focused on summer learning loss, but they essentially modeled three scenarios that they think are possible based on what epidemiologists are sharing with us using NWEA map data. In the first scenario, they assumed that in-class instruction would start in fall 2020 and that the 2020 school year would be typical and quote-unquote normal in terms of kids being in their seats. In the second, they modeled what learning loss might look like if school closures run intermittently through 2020-2021 and kids started school in January 2021. And then in the third scenario, they assumed that in-school instruction couldn't actually start safely until vaccines are available, and so school stays remote for all of next year. I will tell you guys, I struggle to mentally and emotionally process those second two, but know they might be the reality that our kids and our teachers and our communities are facing. In that second scenario where in-class instruction doesn't resume until January 2021, McKinsey estimated that students who remain enrolled could lose 3 to 4 additional months of learning if they receive what McKinsey is thinking of as average remote instruction and 7 to 11 months of learning if they receive lower quality remote instruction, and finally a year's or more worth of learning if they don't receive any remote instruction at all. They do tease out in that study the different impacts that might be expected on both kids of color and kids from low-income backgrounds. And unsurprisingly, they think the impact will be worse because they drew some conclusions based on digs they have done about the fact that students from low-income backgrounds and students of color are receiving lower quality remote instruction right now.
Those statistics are alarming. You're right. I can't even process any of that right now.
I told y'all, I have a 4-year-old who I need to go back to school. Right. I also safe and healthy, but I need him to go back to school.
Yes, exactly. So you mentioned earlier, and I don't know if you want to answer this next question or if Kate might want to jump in either way. You mentioned earlier about the loss in math would likely be greater than that in literacy. Do you all have an opinion on why that might be the case? Just to share with our educators some of the ideas behind that concept and then what they might be able to do to support math along with their literacy support?
I can take that one. I have a few hunches as to why that's the case. So if we leave reading foundational skills to the side for a minute and just look at college-ready reading standards, we know that those are really a description of the processes that our students employ and integrate as they read grade level text for meaning. And we know from research that those processes are not really a set of discrete separate skills. Instead, they're deeply integrated in proficient readers. So when we read for meaning as proficient readers, we're always attending to the key ideas and details in what we're reading. We're always examining authors' craft. We're always integrating the ideas and arguments in the text we're reading with what we already know because we are seeking to make meaning. So I think given that deep integration of the standards, in excellent literacy classrooms, we're seeing the reading standards spiraled across the year. And students have lots and lots and lots of opportunities throughout the year to practice reading for meaning. And the actual grade by grade distinctions in the standards are not vastly different in the reading standards specifically. It's just that students are expected to apply them to texts of increasing complexity. That's really different than mathematics, because mathematics, on the other hand, is coherent and builds across grade levels. So for example, if we had a first grader who struggled with their conceptual understanding of addition within 10, it's going to be really difficult to build their ability to add within 20 if they have not yet mastered that.
Right.
The other thing I would say on this is that we know from research that knowledge and vocabulary play a huge role in our ability to comprehend what we read. And I do have a hunch that schools and families might be better at providing texts and materials and experiences over the summer or during school closures that continue to build students' knowledge and vocabulary, as opposed to building their mathematical understandings. But that does make me really, really concerned about extended school closures, because a lot of that is going to be driven by family resources and experiences at home.
Right. We know that math is scary to most educators, let alone to families.
Yes, exactly. And then the final thing I would just add is, of course, the story for discrete skills for like foundational skills and the language standards is pretty different. So those are skills that are explicitly taught. And students will likely really struggle to apply them if instruction was missed during school closures. So I'm really concerned that our youngest students will experience the greatest learning loss in reading.
Going off of that, do you have any advice for teachers about support that they could offer their parents and families out there if we return to a remote learning situation, or even to help enhance summer learning?
So I think I would, and Bailey, jump in if you would add anything, but I would really charge districts and schools to think about how to provide really robust and rigorous learning experiences remotely to try and minimize the impact on learning loss, and really authentically partner with families and help them understand how they can support their students at home. I don't think we can expect or ask families to explicitly teach foundational skills at home. This is, you know, teachers train for years and work really hard to refine and hone their skills to deliver that kind of instruction. But I think we can do better to authentically partner and work with families to help them understand that instruction, provide them with really robust and rigorous resources, and give them ideas about how to support their kids at home.
The only thing I would add there, I totally agree with what Kate said. I think that a part of providing those robust resources has to be thinking about, as I know listeners have been thinking about, but it has to be thinking about providing accessible experiences for kids, regardless of, you know, some of the resources they have at home. I do think that in mathematics specifically, there are some strong resources like Zurn, which is a K-5 program that is found online, that could support parents and families in giving their kids high quality mathematics experiences on a device if they have one and access to the internet. That can make math a little bit less scary, given the scariness that you all called out.
Yeah.
Just thinking along those lines, I read through your article and read through some other research, and there are so many possibilities, as you noted earlier, about what school reentry could look like. And I know here in West Virginia, actually, as we speak, the State Board of Education is hosting their meeting where the interim superintendent is providing recommendations for that. So we honestly don't know because we're tied up here, but I'm curious to know. One of the recommendations we talked about in our last episode was for school systems to come up with plans that would address multiple reentry scenarios so that at the last minute when something is decided, schools aren't scrambling to make a great decision. Do you have thoughts on how they might be able to do that? What process could they follow in order to come up with some scenarios?
For sure. And let me start by saying that teachers and school leaders and system leaders have some of the hardest jobs in the world.
Absolutely. Right? Especially right now.
Right? As I think about, you know, what we've essentially said to school systems right now is some version of, you've got to figure out how to do this really hard thing in an uncertain context when you don't know what your budget's going to be.
Right.
So that's a hard ask in any scenario, especially when we're thinking on the scale of public education. The other thing we know from some recent representative surveys that have gone out is that both teachers and families are nervous about coming back in person right now, given the uncertainty that still seems to surround the coronavirus. I've seen some estimates that say up to 25% of teachers are saying they're not going to come back if there aren't social distancing measures in place. And again, about 25 to 30% of families saying, we're not sure if we're going to go back to school in 2021. We might choose to keep our kid at home, even if the buildings are open wow. because of public health mm-hmm. implications. And so as I think about systems making decisions in that context, I think it is vital that systems are planning for 2 to 3 scenarios. I think there's the scenario that we generally know how to plan for, which is, you know, maybe you are in a system or a community where public health officials deem it safe for kids to come back like normal. And so kids are back. Even if that happens, I suspect that there will be places where we think it's safe for kids to come back in August or September, then in October or November are saying going back to remote learning because we've had flare-ups. And so I think systems should be planning for a fully remote scenario, an in-person scenario, and then a hybrid scenario. I would name that even if you're planning for the in-person scenario, it feels to me pretty likely that there's going to need to be a remote aspect of that, either because you're going to be planning on doing work and then we're going to have a flare up that results in a shift to remote, or because a subset of your students are staying home. Mm-hmm. We think about the scenarios that systems are planning for right now. We think one of the most important things systems can do is get really, really clear on what content they're going to be teaching next year to overcome the learning loss that students are likely going to come back with, whether they're coming back, you know, virtually or in person. The Learning Acceleration Guide on our website really outlines our take on how to do that in detail. But I would just name that we've seen historically that when we suspect there's learning loss or a lack of learning, we've sometimes retained kids. We've sometimes socially promoted them. We've sometimes remediated them, gone back and just taught them the stuff from previous year's content that they failed to learn. And I think we have evidence in the research literature that none of those strategies works particularly well. So we would encourage students to get really clear on, for the grade level standards that kids should be in, the most critical prerequisite skills and knowledge that kids are going to need to master, and then to adjust their scopes and sequences to reflect that spending time on the most critical skills and knowledge. An example of that is, you know, first graders could come back in the fall. They, you know, are supposed to, in the first grade mathematics standards, learn telling time on analog clocks to the nearest hour and half hour. They're also supposed to learn how to add within 20. As you think about those two standards, we would say for next year, you might have to throw out telling time on the analog clock and spend more time focused on the adding and within 20, knowing that that's going to be more clutch to kids being successful in mathematics moving forward. Mm-hmm. Systems adapt their scope sequences to reflect that guidance and to support teachers in making clear, hey, this is where we should spend our time, given that it's limited, given that we know kids missed a ton of stuff last year, and also knowing that we probably don't just want to go back and teach last year again, because we're going to inadvertently dig a deeper hole for kids if we take that approach. And I worry there'll be a set of kids that never catch up if we don't prioritize really deeply the most important content that the kids should be learning in their current grade level and focus on that. Kate, what would you add?
Yeah, I think I would just share that that's exactly what the teachers and leaders I'm working with are doing right now. I have a partner who says, learning's not a place, it's what we do. And so we're really focused on figuring out exactly what the learning will look like next year, what we want to prioritize next year to accelerate access to grade level content, and then from there, apply it to those different scenarios Bailey laid out, because once we have a really clear sense of what our plan is for the learning, we can think about how to do that remotely or in a hybrid setting.
Right. And we touched on that concept in our last podcast a little bit, how you really need to focus on your standards. And as teachers, you really want to go back and fill in those holes with some of the others, but how to prioritize and pick which is the most important and to provide the scaffolds and differentiation to get your students there. So we are winding down on time, and I would like to ask you ladies a final question. So Bailey, feel free to go first. What is one tip or piece of advice around this summer learning loss topic that you could give our listeners to help them to continue to develop as leaders of literacy?
Make sure the texts you're going to use over the summer and next year are high quality. As a part of my job at TNTP, I spend a bunch of time in classrooms around the country and still see a whole bunch of kids reading below grade level texts or reading, you know, quick snippets of paragraphs that teachers have written to practice a specific literacy skill. Instead of taking that approach, this summer do a check to make sure that your texts are worth your kids' time and attention, and that they're really aligned with the college and career ready expectations for both quantitative and qualitative complexity, and that they're building kids' knowledge of the world. Building kids' knowledge of the world is certainly a long game, but I think it's the best way we can ensure that we are addressing the learning loss that kids might have as a result of the pandemic.
How about you, Kate?
Well, it's hard for me to just share one tip. But if forced, I would say think about your plan to address learning loss as really as a plan to accelerate and support access to grade level text, not delay access to grade level text. Because I think as literacy educators, we have to really reorient from the question of what do kids need before we give them grade level text to the question, what do kids actually need to be able to read, understand, and express their understanding of grade level text?
To access links from the resources discussed in today's episode and for additional information, please visit our website at wvde.us/leaders of literacy. Click on the podcast icon and click on episode 16 to access the show notes. Want to learn more about being a leader of literacy? Be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss a single installment. In the next episode, I'm so happy to be welcoming back my co-host for the month, Brittany Fike. Brittany and I are going to be talking about how to be mindful of culturally responsive education during school reentry. You won't want to miss it. Thanks for listening.